Okay. Good morning. We're going to begin our class on how to celebrate Purim. This is going to be a challenge in the hour and a quarter that we have to get all of Purim in. And we'll try our best to get it done. So some things will go quicker through and some things will take a little longer. So we start with Monday. Monday morning is Tanis Esther. It's the fast of Esther. The reason why we fast is we know that when Haman made his decree to kill the Jewish people, Esther and Mordechai, they told the Jewish people to fast for 3 days. Now that fast, by the way, was later on in the year. That fast was on Pesach for 3 days. So that was the first fast, but following that, on the 13th of Adar, the day that it was written in the letters to kill the Jews, and when the Jews were able to respond back, the Jews were able to fight back, and tradition tells us that when the Jewish people went to war, they would do teshuva, when you went to battle, and part of the aspects of teshuva was fasting. So the Jewish people would fast when they went to battles, and that was on the 13th of Adar. And that was the day before Purim. And therefore, since they fasted, we do the same thing.
So this fast is later than the 3 day fast, you say? Because the 3 day fast must be.
Right. The 3 day fast was when Haman drew the lots. And as soon as they found out that was Pesach time, they fasted 3 days. And 11 months later, on the 13th of Adar, they fasted. Now, as well, it's a practical thing because Purim is preceded by a fast. When what we try to do on a fast day, you try to purify your body to get it to a good place. And just like before the Jewish people received the Torah, they had to purify themselves to receive the Torah. We know Purim has certain aspects of where the Jews re-accepted the Torah upon themselves. So we need to purify ourselves and get ourselves ready to understand how to celebrate in a feasting way without going overboard. And we preface that by doing tshuva on this Tanis Esther.
Didn't the Jews partake of a big feast by Ahasuerus?
Right. One of the things they did wrong was to enjoy the feast of Ahasuerus. So this was also doing tshuva for that, so to speak, by not eating and staying away from those physical things. And really this whole fast, and we call it Tanis Esther because it's a reminder that Hashem hears and sees the plight and prayer of every person in the time of his need. So if he fasts and returns wholeheartedly to Hashem as our ancestors did, and Hashem saved us as well, so he will save us. So this fast, therefore, is different than all the other fasts that we have. Tisha B'Av, Tzom Gedal, all those are focused more on the destruction of the temple, and therefore we're much stricter on those fasts, and this is the most lenient fast of the year. Because it's not a fast commemorating the destruction of the temple. It's more of a fast to get us in the right spiritual mindset for Purim. So number one, like every fast, it starts at sunrise, at dawn, and ends at dusk, at when the stars come out. So that means for our terms this year, the fast begins at 5:22 a.m. and it ends at 7:05 p.m. You can take a sheet over there. And adult males and females over bar and bar mitzvah are obligated to fast, but there's a lot of room for leniencies. Pregnant and nursing women, they're exempt from fasting. A person who's ill, even not seriously ill, is not allowed to fast. Even if you have a severe headache, where on other fasts we'd say you should keep fasting, but if you have a severe headache, you don't have to fast this coming Monday on Tanis Esther. Children under bar or bat mitzvah, you don't even have to train them in fasting, let's say to fast till lunch or till a certain hour. However, we shouldn't have let them eat treats on a fast day, but we're much more lenient. And like any other fast day, if the doctor says you have to take medications, you're certainly allowed to take medications. And if you have difficulty swallowing pills without water, you could take a very, very little amount of water to help you drink take the medicine. So that's a much bigger leniency. Well, no, that is by any fast day, most fast days as well. Now, when you get up in the morning, your mouth usually doesn't taste as good as you like it to taste. So the problem is if you put water in your mouth, there could be the likelihood that you will swallow it. So therefore, you're allowed to take a small amount of liquid, about less than about 3 ounces or so, and you could rinse your mouth out, but you have to do it while leaning over the sink. Like, instead of gargling and leaning back, you lean forward that small amount so that no way can any liquid get swallowed by mistake. And you could rinse your mouth out if it gives you discomfort for not washing out your mouth. If you're the kind of person, you have, you know, bad breath when you wake up and it bothers you, okay, we can be lenient and let you rinse your mouth out in that fashion. Now, if you are an early riser and you want to get up before 5:22 a.m., so you can eat before 5:22 a.m. If you make, when you go to bed and you explicitly say, or at least you explicitly think, that before I go to sleep, I'm planning getting up early and eating, you're allowed to do that. You can eat until, as long as you finish and everything's done before 5:22. Again, not to be confused with the 3 weeks and fasts that are associated with that. You're allowed to take a bath on this fast, even with hot water. You can listen to music. It's a different kind of a fast day. But there's certain things that are the same as a fast day. By Mincha, we say the Anenu prayer for those that are fasting. We say Avinu Malkeinu in the morning, but not by Mincha, because by Mincha it's already getting close to Purim. And under normal circumstances, we also have one more thing we do, is that although the fast ends at 7:05, the custom is to not eat or drink until after the Megillah is read or heard. So that really extends it beyond 7:05. It'll extend at least till 8 o'clock for most people. Now, you know, if you're a healthy person, then you're able to do that. If you're sick or you're weak, and you know there's no way I can concentrate on the Megillah, I'm not feeling so strong, and to sit through an hour Megillah reading is just not going to make it. So you could be lenient, and you could eat a little bit and drink a little bit beforehand. However, I'm sorry? It's a little bit consistent. Whatever you need to keep you going. Like, you wouldn't make a whole feast right then. You need to drink some water, have a piece of cake, something to get the sugar back into the bloodstream, so to speak, and get yourself up. But there's always it's like a catch-22 though. What do we mean? Because when do we start reading the Megillah? We'll find out. You can't read the Megillah until nightfall. When do you have to fast? Until nightfall.
But we read the Megillah on Tuesday morning.
No, Monday night. We're talking about Monday night. First reading is Monday night.
Right.
So by the time the fast ends at 7:05, usually the Gaboim and everybody wants to start right away. They're going to start reading the Megillah at 7:05. So you're not going to have any time to eat by the time the fast is over and by the time the Megillah starts. That's the same time. So that's usually a technical problem. So what is going to happen, like in our shul, for example, we're going to do a couple Megillah readings at 7 o'clock and 7:05, and there's going to be one that's going to start like 5 minutes later. And in some shuls, they don't start right on time. So if you see it 7:05 on your clock and they haven't started the Megillah yet, and you really can't fast much longer, then quickly take a little drink, a little bite, if you can't go on, and that helps you in that area. Certainly, let's look at another scenario. Let's say housewives who stay with the kids while the husband goes out to hear the Megillah, and the wife's not going to hear Megillah reading till 9:30, a late Megillah reading. It would be, you know, unreasonable to assume that the woman should wait until 9:30 to break her fast. So at that point, once it's 7:05, she can eat, and there's no problem of waiting until after the Megillah is read. However, a healthy person that's not suffering and is pretty alert for the Megillah should be fasting until the end of the Megillah. And I always tell people it's a good rule of thumb to go bring some of your own food to shul. Because if, you know, although in shul, right after the Megillah reading, we'll have all kinds of vendors open for food, but there's a great likelihood there'll be a lineup, and people, when they're hungry and they're put a lot of people that are hungry and waiting in line, it usually does not make for a very festive atmosphere. So what I usually do every year is I bring a small water bottle like that, and couple pieces of cake. I have a bag right next to me. As soon as it goes over, I take my drink and have my little cake. And even if you just want to get out of the shul, it takes so much time until you'll get home and this and that. So there's nothing wrong with that. And that way, as soon as you're allowed to eat, at that moment you can begin eating. So that is the fast of Esther, to get us into the right mindset. And there's really a lot to be said that, you know, being in a fasting state during the Megillah really helps you focus more on the spiritual message of the Megillah. So it takes a bit of self-control to not focus so much on how tired you are, but to really get into the Megillah, which is coming up soon. So that's the fast of Esther. Okay, moving on to the next custom. There's a custom to give a half a shekel coin. Okay? A half a shekel coin. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when we had a temple, every Jewish male over 20 years old gave a half shekel. A shekel was a silver coin that the Jewish people had, and a half a silver coin. And it was given in the month of Adar, because the Jewish fiscal year for animal offerings was from the month of Nisan, and Adar is the month before that. And Jews all around Israel would donate the half shekel coin, and that money would go towards all the communal offerings that were brought the entire year. And that was the half shekel coin. So we don't have the temple anymore, but it is still the month of Adar, and we hope that one day the Beis HaMikdash will be built. So to remember that custom of giving the half shekel coin, we all give the machatzis ha-shekel, this half shekel coin. So the custom is to give three half silver coins, because in the Torah, when it talks about the donation of the truma, it mentions the word truma three times, and there were three different types of gifts that were there to build the Beis HaMikdash. And again, you know, part of the whole Purim theme, you have to remember the whole Purim story, the party that, I don't want to get into details here, but the party that Ahasuerus made was to celebrate the fact that he believed, according to his calculation, that the Jews would not return to Jerusalem and not build a second temple. And the whole party was celebrating the fact that God's relationship with the Jews had ceased. The proof being that the prophecy of the Jews returning after 7 years didn't come true. Now, he miscalculated, and he didn't realize that. So the party was to celebrate there'd be no more Beis HaMikdash. So you could take a clean copy. Like don't feel bad. We have a lot of copies. You can get a clean copy. So we bedafka do something that is symbolic of the Beis HaMikdash. And when we had a Beis HaMikdash, we would give those half coins, and we give three of them, because there were three different types of donations that were given. And that is a custom. It's not a law, but it's a custom. Women do not give this machatzis ha-shekel. And the reason why is because the whole point of the half shekel coin, it's an atonement for the sin of the golden calf.
So in this day and age, who do we give it to?
Hold on. We'll get to it.
Three different people.
No. We'll get to it. So the fact that we have the temple service and the animals are there to give atonement, it's for the original sin of the golden calf that the Jewish people did after the Torah was given at Sinai. But we know only the men sinned with the golden calf and not the women. And therefore, this giving of the half coin is to remediate the spiritual flaw that men have. The men didn't want to even contribute to building the Mishkan because they felt so despondent after they knew they weren't going to have a big, big Mishkan after they sinned. It was the women who insisted that we continue. So again, for those women who feel, oh, how come I can't do this mitzvah? You're not losing anything. It's like the skinny person saying, how come you're not putting me on a Dr. Bernstein diet? I feel like I'm left out. Well, all the overweight people are on the Dr. Bernstein diet. It's not fair. I wish I could go on the diet too. What for? You're skinny, healthy, and good. What are you going to the doctor for? So the same thing. The men are giving that machatzis ha-shekel coin because they still carry the taint of the sin of the golden calf, which is basically a sin of ego. And the whole point of the half coin is to show you don't have an ego. A person with an ego thinks I'm a full, I'm everything, I'm complete. The half coin is saying I'm only half. And that's the whole message of Purim. The whole message of Purim is Jewish unity. So you come into Purim giving the half coins, realizing I'm only a half, and I hope through Purim I get a lot closer to everybody. So therefore, the women do not give at all, and the men are the ones that are obliged to give. Yeah?
I just gave yesterday with Chabad, with a bunch of ladies. So what was the purpose? I thought it was for the census. Rather than
the census, again, the census was not to count women. They only counted men.
But isn't it at the same time as in this framework?
No, like not exactly.
Before Purim.
No. There was usually not a census. There was usually not a... Generally, Jews do not do censuses. We don't count Jews. It's a very negative thing. Counting means we're limiting. If we say there's 15,428,723 Jews, that kind of... We've put a number on it. and we're kind of limiting what the Jewish people are. We do not do census. We only did a census a couple times in history for particular reasons after the sin of the golden calf, how many Jews were killed. But generally we do not count Jews. The original half shekel was to count, but it was never done afterwards, and they didn't count Jews on a yearly basis.
So was that before Pesach then? I know that there was a time frame that we could do it. In other words, why did I do that with the other woman yesterday? I've been doing it for the past few years.
To give a machasis a shekel? It
was three coins.
So you were, what can I say, misguided.
Well, at least it was to that guy.
It was misguided. Women do not give the machasis a shekel. There's no reason for you to give. There's other mitzvahs of tzedakah to give. There's plenty of tzedakah to give on Purim for men and women. But the half shekel coin, the women have nothing to do. It's not their problem. They don't have a problem. They don't have to deal with it. Women don't have such a big problem with unity. Guys have a bigger problem with their egos. It's totally not consistent with Jewish tradition for women to give a half shekel coin. So the men have to give. So I made the calculations. You have to have a certain amount of silver, really, in those coins. Those coins should have about almost 10 grams of silver. So if you check out what that costs, now I don't see too many of you going around with half shekels. So we don't have half shekels from the times of the temple. So the custom is that we take whatever the denomination of a legal tender in your country, you take half of that. And that would be a half a dollar. Now the truth of the matter is, if you try to go to the bank now, they will not give you any half dollar coins. There used to be half dollar coins in Canada that had silver in them. And so go try to find one. And you would have to give three half dollar coins. And those would be the amount of silver in those comes out to approximately the value of $5. It's about $5 what it would cost you to do that. So what do we do in shul to make it easy for everybody? So we have three half dollar coins that are going back to the 60s or 70s. We keep them in shul. And there's a little plate that we put out right after mincha. We put out the plate over there, and the three coins are there. Now what you do is you go and you buy the coins from the shul. So what you do is you put coins cost $5. You put five or more, whatever you want to give, put $5 in the plate to buy the coins. You pick the coins up and your hand says, they're mine, I've purchased them. Now, there's the coins. They're my coins, as a matter of fact. So to remember that for the record. So these are Canadian half dollar coins. So that was in the plate. You put $5 in. I pick it up. You have to pick up. It's mine. Right? Now I'm going to do the mitzvah. I'm putting in the three coins, and I've done the mitzvah. I've given the three coins. And the next guy comes along, and then he buys the three coins. And then he puts the three coins in. And that way we ensure that everybody is fulfilling the mitzvah properly.
So how do we get to the situation where you're going to give the coins to three poor people?
We didn't get to that situation yet. Hang on. We're not up to there yet. Now, who is obliged in this mitzvah? So really the mitzvah is for an adult male. And according to some opinions, only over 20 years old. Because really the obligation, the Torah, was only from 20 years and up. People under 20 weren't obliged to give that. The custom has devolved that even boys over 13 have to give. And usually what happens is that the father gives on behalf of his children. Or he could do it with his children. So you could give your son $5 and say, here's $5, go do the machatzis shekel coin. What if you have younger children? So custom, again, is I give enough money to cover all the kids. So I've got two or three boys under bar mitzvah. They each would need their own machatzis shekel. $5 a pop. Me, $5, $20. Put $20 in, I'll take the machatzis shekel give for them. So there's different customs in this area, and you don't have to get so nervous if you're doing it properly or not. But clearly, if you're over 20 years old, everybody does the custom. Over 13, most people do the custom. And if you want to do it for your kids and you want to train them, you could certainly a beautiful thing to do. You bring your son to shul, even if he's 8 years old, say, here, we're doing the machzis shekel. Here, I'm giving you $5. Here, go buy the machzis shekel. It's a beautiful thing to train a child in doing. Okay, now, what do we do with all that money that's been collected? So if you've got whatever, 100 people in shul, and they each gave $5, you got $500. So in the temple, what we did, we go buy animals. And we use for animals. We don't have any animals to buy. So the custom is to give it to the poor. So the shul would keep it, and we'll give it out on Purim. So Leonard, you remind us, okay, that we should give the money to you guys, okay, and then it goes to the poor. So that's what the custom is, and it shouldn't be used, let's say, to fix the lights in the shul or things like that. If you forgot to give, and usually that's done at mincha of the fast day of Tanis Esther, because people are usually in shul then, most people have come to shul, and it's still a little bit of time between then and before you can have a mara for Megillah reading, usually about a 15-20 minute break, there's time on your hands, so during that time, that's when you give it. If you forgot and didn't give it on Erev Purim, you can give it Purim morning, before you hear the Megillah is also fine, or any other time the rest of Purim. Now, there's another topic that's going to come up over and over. We know there's a concept called ma'aser money. Ma'aser money. Ma'aser means a tenth. Every Jew is obliged to give a tenth of his net earnings to tzedakah. I don't want to get into the questions. How do you calculate the tenth? It'll be another class for another time. On a simple level, if you have $100,000 of disposable income, so you should over the course of the year give $10,000 to tzedakah. General rule of thumb. There's exceptions, but let's say, okay. So now you got to give that to tzedakah. So you give it to tzedakah, this institution, this organization, this person. So now you say, okay, I got to give $10,000. Let me allocate some of that money for the machatzis shekel. So you're not allowed to do that. Why? Because there's a rule. Tzedakah is one thing, and personal obligations is another. You have to give, you have a mitzvah to give a half shekel coin, like we'll see with other mitzvahs on Purim. And in Judaism, we don't allow the rule, kill two birds with one stone. Well, I gotta give tzedakah anyway. And it's getting a little tight this year with the tzedakah. So, you know, I have to give machatzis shekel. Since I have to give that, I'll use that out of my tzedakah money. You're not allowed to do that because it's a, machatzis shekel is a personal obligation of redemption. Because the half shekel coin was really atonement and redemption. So you need to be redeemed every Erev Purim. So I can't use my tzedakah money for redemption, because really what we would have done, we would have bought a korban for that, and that's not tzedakah. In the temple, you would have bought an animal offering. That's certainly not tzedakah. So this whole activity, even though the money will ultimately go for tzedakah, but you can't take it out of your tzedakah budget. And we'll see all the mitzvahs of Purim work the same way to a certain extent. You can't take it out of your tzedakah budget. But we definitely are setting a good theme of Jewish unity by giving the half shekel coin. And realize as I come to Purim, I'm only half a Jew. And hopefully if I can bond with other fellow Jews over Purim, then I will have succeeded in accomplishing the goal of Purim. Okay, next page. The prayers of Purim. The prayers of Purim are generally the same as a weekday prayers. It's not a Yom Tov in terms of saying Hallel and Musaf and things like that. But all we do is make certain additions. So in each of the Shemona Esrays, in each of the Amidas, during the bracha of Modim, where we give thanks to Hashem, we add a paragraph called Al Hanisim, for the miracles that Hashem did. And we recall the miracles of the Purim story and how the continuous miracles that God does for us in our lives. You do that every time you say Shemon Esrei, Mariv, Shachris, and Mincha. And also if you eat bread and you bench, in the bracha of Noda Lecha, you add the Al Hanisim as well. And that's part of your prayers. If you forget to say it, you need not repeat the Shemon Esrei. You need not repeat the benching. Since it is a happy day, the more serious prayers, such as Tachanun, where we fall on our face after Shemon Esrei to plead and supplicate before God, and the prayer of Lam Natzeach, they're omitted in the morning. In the morning, we do take out a Torah before we read the Megillah. We take out a Torah, and we read about the battle with Amalek. The first battle of Amalek against the Jews, because Haman was a descendant of Amalek before the Megillah reading. And that's the extent of the changes of the prayers. No Tachnun the whole day. Now, we don't even do it Erev Purim. We don't say Tachnun either. Now, here's a law that some people aren't aware of. We know, we'll discuss later, there's a custom to get dressed in costumes on Purim. Now, the question is, can you daven in your costume? So the halacha really is you should not daven in costume. You shouldn't daven in costume because davening is something that's supposed to be done respectfully. And if you're dressed up like Mickey Mouse or whatever, it's not exactly the most serious way to come before the Almighty. So I admit it presents a challenge. Because let's say you're going for Purim night and you want to be dressed up for the festivities that are after the Megillah reading and after Maariv. So, you know, if you're going to shul for Maariv, you got to be dressed up properly for Maariv. So what you really would have to do is you have to bring a change of clothing. And then after Maariv, after Megillah, you go to the washroom and then change into your costume. All right? So, okay. So, you know, there's costumes and there's costumes, you know. If you're dressed up like a Hasidic Rebbe, so then you could daven like that because there's nothing foolish about it. You know, if in your heart you really wish you were a Chassid. So you dress up like a Chassid with a big hat and this and that. And okay, so you know what? That's not inconsistent with davening. Right? But if you're dressed up like a Hell's Angel biker or something, or Haman, or this and that, it's not exactly consistent with davening Maariv, or any of the prayers. So, you know, and the whole nature, you're looking at people, you're laughing, ooh, he's so funny. It's nothing wrong to have costumes to hold Purim. It's a beautiful thing. But not when you're davening. You have to learn how to draw the line. Okay, little kids, I wouldn't necessarily make them crazy with that, but adults should, as much as possible, try to accomplish that.
What is the object of dressing up?
We'll get to that. That's at the end of the class. We're going to get to that. All right. Now, of course, we know on Purim as well, and specifically by Mincha and Maariv, that the men will discuss, get a little bit, drink a little bit. So the problem is, what if they get to an intoxicated state? Can they daven Mincha or Maariv the next day? Or Shacharis, for that matter. So the halacha is, can you daven when you're intoxicated? So the answer is, if you're intoxicated to the extent that you can't speak respectfully to an important person, then you can't daven. You can't talk to God that way. It's a chutzpah. You better not to daven. Wait till you get sober. If you're only slightly intoxicated, you're a little bit high, but you could talk respectfully to an important official. Then it's correct not to pray, not forbidden, but correct not to pray. The custom on Purim is we're a bit lenient in that area. If you're only a little bit high, but you can still speak respectfully, we're lenient to daven. Although ideally you should wait till you're sober, but you may not have a minyan later, so you got to be careful. The men have to be careful in terms of being in a sober state to daven. If they're too intoxicated, they shouldn't daven. Okay, next topic, work. Are you allowed to work on Purim? So again, Purim is not an official holiday from the Torah, so the prohibitions of work are not biblically sanctioned. And certainly at night, which is the less holy part of Purim, you're allowed to do any kind of work. If you got to go to your store and do something, you can do any work at night, technically. The day is where there's more of a problem. The custom is to prohibit any kind of work on the daytime of Purim. And the rabbis say very clearly, anyone who works on Purim will not see any blessing from the money they make on Purim. So we're not going to prohibit it to you. We're not going to disallow you from working. But you should know the custom is not to work. The custom is to take off that day. Don't plan important business meetings. And if you do, you don't count on any blessing from that. But certain work would be permitted. Let's say if you don't go to a certain meeting, you're going to incur a tremendous financial loss for your business. You know, what if the president of the company is giving you an evaluation today, and if you don't, you fail and you lose your whole business. Okay, you would not be able to celebrate Purim knowing that you're going to be losing thousands and thousands of dollars. So that kind of work you could do. Certainly any work that's required to do a mitzvah. You know, like on Shabbos, you can't drive a car, but if you want to deliver Shalach Manas, you can go in your car. You're doing a mitzvah. Anything that has to do with the mitzvah of Purim, and anything that's required for Purim. Any mitzvah you need to do, and any Purim needs, can be taken care of. But things that are beyond, so Purim is, for example, not a day to get the mail. Like, who gets the mail on Purim? Like, what, unless, mamish, you're expecting, something that's gotta be signed that day, and you'll lose the mortgage on your house. If you don't sign, it's coming in the mail. But I'm saying, generally speaking, most mail is garbage, and anything that you get, even if it's a bill, you don't have to get it today. You can get it tomorrow. So that's the kind of thing. Like, why get the mail on Purim? There's so much more to do on Purim that you wouldn't want to do such a thing. So those things that aren't necessary, you know, it's not the time to start, painting the house. It's not the time to do any of that stuff. It's really a time to focus on the beautiful things that Purim has. What you have to do, you have to do. But beyond that, we don't do. On the other hand, you could ask a non-Jew to work for you. There's no prohibition. Now, you can't do that on Shabbos. But on the weekdays, you could ask, on Purim, you could ask a non-Jew to work for you. Laundering clothes, for example. Well, I'm home. I might as well do the laundry. No, you don't do the laundry on Purim. Unless the kids have no clothes to wear on Purim. Then you can do the laundry. You don't shave. You don't take a haircut. Just because I got time. It's a day off. Unless you haven't had a chance to shave. And you shave every day, let's say. And you want to look nice on Purim. Then, of course, you could shave. But otherwise, we don't do that. You shouldn't cut your nails on Purim. And the custom is to wear Shabbos clothes on Purim. The custom is to be dressed like you'd be dressed on Shabbos. However you dress on Shabbos, that's how you should dress on Purim when you're not in a costume. And therefore, the night of Purim, on Monday, you should change into your Shabbos clothes before you go to hear the Megillah. That's how special the time is. Remember, the holiest day of the year, we call Yom Kippurim, the day like Purim. So Purim is a very holy day. So, it's a weekday, it's a Monday, it's a Tuesday, I'm not going to work, I'll just wear my casual dress shirt. Well, that's not the way you dress on Shabbos, that's not the way you dress on Purim. So you have to, so you dress to the prayers in a respectful way, in a dignified way. Okay, if you're going to put on a costume, then you put on a costume. So either you're wearing Shabbos clothes or a costume. That's basically the way a person should dress on Purim.
Are you allowed to shave on Tanis Esther?
Yes, if you're allowed to shave on Tanis Esther, if you want to shave in honor of the Megillah, you can do that too. There's no prohibition on that. Okay, so now we got the mindset. We're blocked off from work. We're not working on Purim. We tried our best not to work on Purim. It's not a day to start, checking your emails and all that kind of stuff, unless there's something pressing and you're expecting an important email. That generally stay away from those things. Any work we do has to do with mitzvahs and Purim.
So now, on the day of the fast, you're allowed to work.
Day of fast, you work the whole day. Work the whole day till the Megillah. And if you're coming late for whatever reason, let's say you can't close your store till 8:30. You can't. There's nobody there. You couldn't get anybody else. So you could work till 8:30 and you go to a later Megillah reading. Again, it's not optimal. It's not optimal. Optimal is to fast until Megillah reading here, the Megillah reading. But, it's a complicated world. And sometimes you just can't. You can't. You're a nurse. You're a doctor. You got a business. And you tried your best to close it and you couldn't for whatever reason. And you arranged to, you told the two goyim to, you guys close up. And they call you 4 o'clock. No, we're sick. We're leaving early. Right? And this customer, you have to stay. Okay? If you have to stay, you have to stay. But you still have to hear the Megillah. But hopefully, as we get more experience with Purim, we plan our calendar well in advance. And we know in a month before, and I don't book any appointments, I'm taking off. You should really look at it as a day off from work. You look at it as Shabbos. Just like on Shabbos, you'd never consider working on Shabbos. So Purim should have that attitude, although if it's really important, there's leniencies for that. So now that we've got ourselves in the right mindset and we're dressed properly, we're not working, now we can focus on the mitzvahs of Purim. Starting with point number 5, which is reading and hearing the Megillah. First rule, every man and woman over bar or bat mitzvah is obliged to hear the entire Megillah 2 times. 2 times. Once at night and once in the morning. Because Hashem brings salvation to us in the evening parts of our lives, when our lives look so confused and confounded and we're in the dark. We need revelation in the dark. And in the daytime, we need revelation as well. So you gotta hear it twice. A lot of people have this idea, well, we go at night, there's no work at night, we bring the kids at night, we hear the Megillah, and that's it. The truth is, the more important reading is the daytime reading. The primary reading is the day, but you gotta do both. You gotta hear the Megillah at night, you gotta hear Megillah in the daytime. And you gotta hear the whole Megillah. Children who are, and I stress, mature enough to listen attentively to the Megillah, and each parent decides what that age is, they should be trained to hear the Megillah. They should be trained to go to shul to hear the public Megillah reading. They obviously need proper supervision by the parents, and they have to understand that they're not just coming to shul to bang at Haman and to shoot off cap guns. They have to be explained. We're hearing the Megillah. It's a very important story. We're going to talk about how Hashem saved the Jewish people. And just like he did then, he's going to do it now. And just like Hashem killed Haman, we hope he's going to take care of all the enemies now and all the Palestinians and all the people who want to hurt us and the Al-Qaedas. And we have these kavanas. Hashem should give us a salvation. So you tell your kids. When you're banging for Haman, it means you're banging for all evil. That's what you're supposed to bring a kid to hear the Megillah. Not just, oh, you want to make a lot of noise? You know, they have to understand what they're coming for.
Is the Megillah read at Shachris after you've done Shachris?
We're going to talk about it. It's coming up. So now, young children who are likely to cause a disturbance and to prevent others from hearing the Megillah, it's our baby, and it's 2-year-old, and it's so good for him to hear the Megillah. He comes to the Megillah, and the kid can't sit still for 30 seconds. And all he's going to do is make noise and start talking and shooting off his cap gun and all these things in the middle. There's no mitzvah to bring them. As a matter of fact, it's not a mitzvah. It's wrong to bring them to hear the Megillah. Because there are people there who want to hear the Megillah. And we'll see shortly how important it is what you have to hear. You bring a child who disturbs, number one, it's not good for you. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for him because it's not age appropriate for him. And he'll have the wrong impression of the Megillah. It's not good for you. You won't hear the Megillah. And it's not good for anybody else because you're disturbing other people from hearing the Megillah. So you say, oh boy, you're very cruel, Rabbi. You're not letting them do anything. So what you do is you design other programs for children that are age appropriate. So in our shul, at the same time we have a kosher Megillah reading, we have a family Megillah experience where we know that this thing is for the little kids and they're not there to hear the Megillah. They're not can't hear, and their parents come and watch them, and they get the Megillah read for them in a way in which they appreciate the Megillah. And then the parents later on go to later Megillah reading, and that's really the fair way to do it. People who want to hear the Megillah should hear the Megillah. Older children who can behave and understand what's going on, they can hear a kosher Megillah reading. But little kids, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, they can't sit for an hour to hear the Megillah. So you'll do a Megillah thing for you guys, so they'll get the experience. They don't know the difference reading from a kosher Megillah reading though, and it's more age appropriate. If you make them sit for 20 minutes to hear the Megillah, they can hang on and they can bang and have the experience, and then they have to do what's age appropriate for them. And that's, you know, people should do that. So you have to bear that in mind. And if people would realize that there's other people around, they wouldn't, and you see people do it. They bring their little baby and I feel sorry for them and all those things. But you bring your little baby and the baby cries in the middle of Megillah and you don't end up hearing anything, you disturb others. And that's why if you got a husband and wife, you make up that the husband goes to the Megillah reading at 7 o'clock and the wife watches the kid at home or takes him to a different Megillah venue that's not a real reading. And then the husband switches, and at 9 o'clock the wife goes and hears the Megillah, the husband watches. So this can be very readily done, and in my mind it just escapes me how people just can't fathom to do that. But that clearly has to happen, and you'll see why. Now the earliest time to read the Megillah is 7:05. You cannot read earlier than that at night. In the morning you can't read it before sunrise, which is 6:32. And you have the entire night time to read the Megillah. All night long can read the Megillah for the nighttime, and all day long until sunset to read the day Megillah. Now, before you read or listen to the Megillah, you have to have in mind that you are doing the mitzvah of reading or hearing the Megillah. The reader has to have in mind that he's doing it for the listeners, and the listeners want him to read for them. We make 3 blessings before the Megillah is read. The brach of Al Mikra Megillah, the blessing that says for the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. The blessing, Sha'asa Nisim, that God does miracles for us, and the Shechayanu Brach that we do every time we do the mitzvah that we haven't done for a long time. And that the custom is, since it's a blessing, we stand to hear those blessings, to hear the blessings. And when we're listening to the blessings, we have in mind that we are fulfilling our obligations that these blessings are requiring of us. When we hear the Shechayanu blessing in the day, we have in mind all the other mitzvahs we're going to do in the daytime that are coming up. We have in mind, as we're hearing these brachas, to fulfill all these mitzvahs of Purim, and the reader has us in mind that he's discharging our obligation with the reading. Puts us on page 3. Now here's a common issue. What happens if you're just a little bit late? Right? And you're walking in as the chazan's making the blessings. This invariably happens. You see, we write Megillah 7 o'clock, so how do people interpret that? I can come, so I'll leave the house at 7 o'clock. Somehow people think from their house to the shul doesn't take any time. It's this thing, you know. Oh, how long can it take? 1 or 2 minutes, right? Then they realize they go to the parking lot and they figure there's already 150 people came before you. You can't park over here. You go to the other parking lot. Uh-oh, now you're running behind. Now you go to the other parking lot and you gotta walk all the way back from the parking lot. You're walking in, guess what? They already started. They already started. And it's very often, and they're not waiting for you. There are people fasting. And they're fasting, so we're not going to wait for the people coming late, so people have to fast longer. So that's why the rabbi is a little crafty. So the rabbi writes that Megillah is 7 o'clock in shul. Right? But the truth is, it's not till 7:05. Okay? So why do I do that? Because I know that people, if you say 7, they don't come at 7. They come 7:02, 7:03, 7:04, 7:05.
And now that we know 7:05, we'll be here at 7. We'll leave the house at 7.
Yeah, so now you guys, maybe I shouldn't have told you. But what happens is, so, oh, it's gotta be so I'm rushing, and you rush, but you always come a couple minutes late. So there are problems like this. If you walk in, and the chazan has already begun reading the Megillah, and he's on the third pasuk, okay? You came just a minute late. That's it. You can't hear the Megillah anymore. You can't do the mitzvah, because you must hear the entire Megillah first word to last word without missing a word.
So
if you don't hear them,
you can't perform a mitzvah.
You can't perform this if you're late. You'll have to go to another minyan. If you came, you come 2 minutes late, and then the fifth pasuk. I'm going to hear 99% of the Megillah. What do you want? The halach is you have to hear the whole Megillah, and there's a lot of spiritual reasons behind that. Because the whole miracle of Purim is that God took every little event that seems to not be connected to anything, that seems to be no rhyme or reason, but really God, every aspect of the Megillah was interwoven, and if any one little detail would have been missing, the Jewish people would have been annihilated. Which shows that God is supervising every moment of our lives, and the whole sense of the Megillah, when you're reading the Megillah, you're reading this story and that story, all these serendipitous events, and it just doesn't seem to. But every part, how does this connect? How does that connect? And God was preparing things years in advance to be ready for this time that's going to happen later. So you've got to relive that. And you can only relive that by hearing every single word. So if you miss one word, you're out of luck. You have to, now even if you don't understand Hebrew, but as long as you're listening and you're hearing it and you're following along, then you fulfill the mitzvah. So if you're coming 2 minutes late, you're finished. So once you come 2 minutes late, so what are you supposed to do? You can sit in there and you can enjoy sitting, but you haven't done the mitzvah. You got to go to another minyan. So that's why we're going to do in shul this year. We called it for 7, so we won't start till 7:05. And then you know there's going to be people coming late, so there's going to be another minyan that we called for 7 that's going to start at 7:10. And when one room gets filled up, we'll send people to go to the other room. And that way, hopefully, you know, as long as people don't let out my secret too much, but to know. That's when they're gonna read. So it's very critical. And therefore you don't want a little kid talking. Imagine if in the Megillah there's a kid yelling and screaming for a whole pasuk. You can't hear a chazan reading if you're hearing a kid screaming right next to you. That means you missed out and you have to hear the Megillah all over again. So if a person realized that, they think twice before bringing little kids to shul. So let's say now you came but you missed the blessings. You're there, everybody's standing, he's in the middle of a blessing. Let's say he said the first blessing and he's on the second one. What do you do now? So the answer is, if there's enough time, say the blessings yourself. Quickly. They're usually going longer. Baruch Atah Hashem. It takes a long time to say the Baruch. So you come in, you miss the Baruch. Quickly, you know, you say the three blessings. Make sure you finish before he starts reading the Megillah. And then you're okay. Because you made the blessings instead of he made the blessings. That's fine. You can make the blessings. If you have enough time to say all the blessings, say as many as you can on your own. If you can't say any of the blessings, and you miss the blessings, but you're there for the Megillah, preferably you should go to another Megillah reading to hear the blessings, but if it's very inconvenient for you, you could hear the Megillah without the blessings. So if you walked right in, and just as you walked in, Vayehi, Bimeach Hashverosh, and you missed the blessings, and you know you're not going to be able to catch another minion, then you can, if you hear the entire Megillah, it's okay. It's okay. Alright, so that's clear about the blessings. All right. When we finish the Megillah, when the minyan, a special blessing is said, and then we conclude singing Shoshanas Yaakov after the Megillah. Although you have to stand for the blessings, for the Megillah reading, you can sit. You're allowed to sit. However, I don't recommend it for a simple reason. most people, if you're like me, you're fasting, you're tired, and you're trying to concentrate. Somewhere in the middle of the fourth chapter, you don't know what happens, and you wake up, it's the fifth chapter. You know, the old dipsy drop. You know, you're looking and, you know, so you're tired. So, and I know I'm liable for that. So what I do, I stand. If you're standing, I've not yet mastered the art of sleeping while standing. I heard can do this. I can't do that. So if I'm standing and I got the McGill in my hand, I can't fall asleep when I'm standing. But technically if you don't have the koyach, you want to sit, certainly you can sit. But if you feel you're going to fall asleep, then standing is a good idea, although you're not obliged to do that. Okay, we did number 11 already. Now what happened if we're, yeah?
Can you be reading along in English?
You cannot be reading along in English. I'll tell you why you can't do that. It's a good thought, but you can't do it. The reason is when you are reading, your ears cannot be hearing. As much as we think we are, you really aren't. You're hearing noise. You gotta, when he says, Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, you have to hear those words. And you're reading and you're saying it wasn't the days of Achashverosh. You can't be hearing those words, Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh. A human being can't do that. It's very hard to do that if you're reading out loud. If you're saying words, if you're talking, you can't be hearing. Unless you're saying the same words. So if you have your own kosher Megillah in the Chazan's reading, and as he's reading Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, you're reading Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, so you're reading out of a kosher Megillah. I don't need him to read, I could read along with him. But if you have a Chumash, which is not a kosher Megillah, your reading is not a kosher reading, but his is, you can't hear him. And especially if you're reading in English, you can't hear him. So if, let's say, a person, they don't know Hebrew at all. They don't know an Aleph from a Beis from a Gimel, and you're just hearing words. So you concentrate on hearing the words, and perhaps you can scan the English. Perhaps, I don't know, you scan the English, but you're not talking, you're hearing the words. To you it's Chinese. Maybe it's Chinese. I could say it in Chinese, it would be no different to you. So still, but he's saying for you and you're listening, that's good. So then you could scan the text. But if you'd be reading the text out loud, you couldn't be hearing.
So you're saying reading is when you're speaking it.
Speaking, talking, scanning, but you have to be very careful that you are still listening to the Hebrew words that you don't understand. You're hearing every word, I'm hearing every word that he's saying, and I'm scanning. So even that's not an easy job. You have to have a lot of concentration, but it's possible. But if you're actually saying the words, that you can't do. Now what happens, Taka, if you got your Megillah in front of you, you got your Chumash, and you're reading, and all of a sudden, a kid screams right next to you. And you know for sure you didn't hear three words. You know you didn't hear it. So instead of getting angry,
you gotta hear it again.
What you're allowed to do for a little bit, you're allowed to read out of the Chumash, or your own copy, read the words that you missed. That's it. You missed three words. You got a Chumash in front of you. You got a text of the Megillah. Read the words that you missed. Now then you're going to say, yeah, but if I'm reading that, then I'm not hearing the next ones he say.
Sure.
So what you got to do is you got to read quickly to overtake the Chazan, to get a little bit ahead till you can now continue. Let's say the middle of the Pasuk, you didn't hear two words, so read quickly to the end of the Pasuk. Hopefully you will have got a second ahead of the Chazan. And when he starts the next Pasuk, then you can listen to what he's saying. So that way all is not lost. Very important thing to know. Some people, they don't know. They know that after every word, a kid makes noise, they get angry. You messed it up for me, and you're stomping out, and I gotta hear another Megillah reading and all that. So, at least if you know how to read Hebrew, then if you read those couple words that you missed, then you're caught up, so to speak, and it's 100% kosher hearing of the Megillah.
You want to hear Megillah.
Even out of a non-kosher Megillah. For a couple words. You can't read a whole Megillah that way, but a couple words, you're allowed to do that. Couple words allowed to do that. Now, it's obviously, that goes without saying, the reader or the listener can't speak at all from the first blessing until the end of the after blessing. You can't speak at all. Let's say if your kid's making noise, you go, hush. Okay, you could do that. But you got to be very careful with that. Now, point 14 says there are four verses in the Megillah which before the Chazan reads, the congregation reads. Four times. All of a sudden the Chazan stops, and then we start talking about Mordechai. A whole pasuk about Mordechai. Every shul reads that pasuk about Mordechai. And then there's some other psukim where Mordechai went out and hit the in the king's garment, and when it was happy for the Jews. And the last verse, I marked down where they are. Four times during the Megillah, where people read out loud before the Chazan. And then the Chazan repeats it. Why? For various reasons. They're high points of the Megillah. They're very important points where miraculous things happened. And also helps us stay awake a little bit. We talk a little bit. So you read that, and then the Chazan repeats it afterwards. As well, it's customary for the congregation to read the 10 sons of Haman. And then the Chazan reads it afterwards. Because since the Chazan is going to say it in one breath, he's going to say it fast, you may not hear it so well. So we say it before, so to make sure we've said it properly. Of course, we know it's a time-honored tradition to bang and make noise every time Haman's name is mentioned. This is not a children's thing. It is part of the mitzvah. The Torah says, "Macho emcha zech Amalek." You're required to obliterate the name of Amalek. Amalek, which represents evil in this world, Haman is the greatest manifestation of the most evil in the world. Every time you hear Haman's name, it should be so repulsive to you that you're making noise. In the olden days, what they did is they would write the word Haman on a piece of wood, like on a solid piece of wood and on another piece of wood, and they would bang the two pieces of wood so that by the end of the Megillah, the name of Haman would be obliterated. And that's how you're obliterating Haman. Okay, so we do it other ways. We make noise and whatever. And it's all part to demonstrably say we oppose evil in this world. And it's not only Haman, but it's Osama bin Laden. It's all the people who want to corrupt this world. We have them all in mind when we're doing this, and it's a mitzvah to do it. It's a mitzvah to do it. Yeah.
Why do we have Haman Teshen?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Right? We'll get that later on. We'll get to that. It's a good question.
And
we'll answer that later.
Also, if we're trying to obliterate his name, why do we? I mean, this whole holiday is constantly, okay.
No, but that's not. We're not cheering Haman. So you're going boo. You know, that's a big difference. When a politician gets up and speaks, right? Either we clap, you know, right on, cheer. Or if you really don't like him, you have counter demonstration, you're booing the guy. You're booing him out. So what we're booing Haman out. That's what we're doing. And we don't glorify Haman. We're smashing and stamping, and that's why the kids have to be told it's not just a cap gun fight. Like even a 5-year-old can understand it. Haman was a terrible man. It's just not simple. He was a terrible man. He wanted to kill all the Yidden. If Haman was alive today, he would take mommy and daddy and kill them. God forbid. That's what you have to tell your little kid. And there are Hamans in the world who would want to do this. And we don't like them. And every time we hear their name, and that's what Hashem doesn't want. We bang and say, if we could go to war now and destroy Amalek, that's what we would do if we could do such a thing. That's a mitzvah to feel that way. And there's a lot of Amalek in this world. It's dressed up in all kinds of glorious ways. There's a lot of Amalek you can buy for money. You know, there's a lot of Amalek. Amalek basically says, doubt the belief in God. You know, and there's all kinds of modern things in this world that manifest Amalek. That we have to learn to obliterate that in our lives. So that's what we're telling the kids to do. But you gotta be careful not to do it excessively. You can't do it until the Chazan says the word Haman. Because if you make noise before he says the word Haman, we won't hear the word Haman as part of the Megillah. So a lot of times the Chazan will repeat the word Haman afterwards. So make sure so don't start banging again. And you know, sometimes kids make trouble. Oh, we're going to make it so hard. Every time there's Haman, we're going to make noise. No one can hear the Haman. You got to hear the mitzvah. You got to hear every word. So you got to be careful not to do it excessively. Now, since this is a very special holiday, there's a specific point of making a public demonstration of the miracle. It's a greater honor for God when there's publicity for this, and therefore everyone should make an effort to go to the public reading that's in shul, as opposed to organizing a private event in your home. Yeah, let's say you know how to read from the Megillah, and you invite some of your friends, and we have 10, 15 people over, we're going to hear the Megillah. That's not proper, because the whole Jewish people were in danger, and we only were saved because we all came together. So Purim's not a time to splinter. So, of course, we don't have one big shul for the whole Toronto. It's not possible. But every kehillah should daven together with their kehillah, with their community, to make as many people be in shul as possible, and not have private sessions going on. If for whatever reason it's impossible for you to go to shul, for whatever reason it was, you're not well or you couldn't go out, then you have to make every effort to have somebody come and read the Megillah for you in your house from a kosher Megillah. That is the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. Okay, we got that. Next. Matanos Avyonin, gifts to the poor. The Megillah writes that the Jewish unity goes to the point of that the rich and the poor, there's no barriers between them. And we have to make sure that the poor can enjoy the holiday as well. One of the greatest barriers between Jews is wealth. One of the greatest things that brings divisiveness to Jews. You know, I don't live in that part of town. You live in this part of town. I'd never be caught dead in such a store, chvase, all these things. And we think we're greater. Rich people think they're better than poor people. So on Purim, we try to erase those barriers and we focus on the poor. And the Megillah says clearly you have to give a gift to two separate Jews that are poor. The gift can either be food or money that can buy food. And there's two points to this mitzvah. Number one, everyone has to have a seuda. Everyone has to have a meal. And poor people don't have the meal. They can't do the mitzvah, the meal. And the primary point of the gifts is to make sure that the poor have what to eat on Purim and to have a meal. Secondary point is a poor person is sad. And you give them money even beyond what their Purim needs are, because they know Pesach isn't that far around the corner. And what Jewish person on Purim can be so happy knowing there's no food for Pesach? So you try to give them money not only for Purim, but as much as you can to even help them for Pesach. So it's not a time to give to schools and to shuls and to organizations on Purim. The focus is on poor people on Purim. That's the real tzedakah. And it's got to go to poor people. You know, if a person says, I'm collecting money for yeshiva, wonderful, I'll give you any time. You can even give them on Purim, but you don't fulfill the mitzvah of giving to the poor. One gift to one person and one gift to another. It should be done in the daytime. It should preferably be done after the Megillah reading without delay to the mitzvah as soon as possible. Now, of course, there aren't too many poor people that you see in shul that you can give to. In Europe, years ago, it was very easy. There were poor people in shul and you gave them. And they were happy to take. Now you go to shul, there really aren't very many poor people in your shul. So what do you do? So we hope that there are charitable collectors who are collecting for the poor that will enable us to fulfill the mitzvah. So therefore the optimal way is you go to a charitable collector, such as Leonard, who takes care of the link for us, and you go to Leonard and say, listen, I know you're going to give money to the poor people today. Here's money. Please give the money today for me. And he's your messenger to give it to the poor people, and then you fulfill the mitzvah 100%, provided he gives it to the poor people on Purim. He can't take money on Purim and give it for Pesach. He has to, actually, the money has to be given on Purim. Now, let's say you know you're not going to see him on Purim. So you got to remember this. So could you give before Purim? So you can, but the collector has to have the following thing in mind. Let's say I want to give Leonard today. I'm not going to see him on Purim. I'm not going to see him. Okay, I'm going to give Leonard. Give me the money today, but I'm giving it to you, and now you're taking it and you're holding it for me. You're not holding it for the poor people. You're holding it for me. And it's my money still. I haven't given it away yet. You're just watching it for me. And now he's taking your money. And on Tuesday, I want you to take my money and I'll give it to the poor people for me. So that way you could fulfill it if you give it before poor. But you have to have that in mind and he has to do that for you. So of course, you can give him a check and he can take it to the bank and he can cash the check and he can take cash. You know, but it's still your money. So Leonard has to realize that he's only holding everybody's money and he's not releasing it until Purim. And when he does it that way, then the mitzvah is fulfilled. So you got to be careful who you're giving the money to, that he knows this. If you give it to the collector beforehand and he doesn't give it out on Purim, then you may not have fulfilled the mitzvah properly.
What happens if you can't manage to give it on the day of Purim?
Let's say you don't have any organization that can collect for you, so what you do is you separate the money, put it aside and say it's designated for the poor people, and when the time comes I'll give.
So then you can give it to them the day other than the day of Purim.
But you have to at least separate the money on Purim. You gotta actually take money out of your pocket or write a check. You could, let's say, write the check and put it in the mail. Let's say you get a lot of checks now. If you're on the hit list, right? You get lots of tzedakas for poor people. So what you could do, in the spirit as well, write checks on Purim and mail them out on Purim. That's also a good thing to do. Is it 100% fulfilling the mitzvah? No, the 100% is you give the money right then on Purim to the poor guy. But let's say you don't have the ability. So that you know, this is for orphans and this is for this. You write a check on Purim, put it in the mailbox on Purim. Then that's a way of fulfilling the mitzvah as well.
Can
Yes.
So up until this year, every year I'm obligated to do it, and Larry's obligated to do it. And this year, like, he wrote a check for both of our remains.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that. We're coming up. We're just coming up to that in a minute. We're going to come up to that. So now, how much money do you have to give? What's the minimum? So the minimum is as much money as it would cost for a person to pay to have a meal on Purim. Okay, so it's subjective, that term, you know, how much it is. So the way I would figure for a Jew in Toronto, if you wanted to have a meal, a down and out guy would go to a restaurant, go to Miami Grill, to have a Purim meal, you'd have to spend about $25 to have a Purim meal. So you should be giving a $25 gift to one poor person and a $25 gift to another poor person. So for you to fulfill your mitzvah, you have to be giving $50. Can't give $50 to one poor person. It's 25 to 125. If you're giving to an organization that's giving out to many people, so your $25 will go to one and your $25 will go to another person. It's all part of the big pot. You know, hundreds of people are being fed with this money. So it usually will get covered. The rabbis say this is such an important mitzvah, you should spend more money on this mitzvah than any other of the mitzvahs of Purim. You should put more money for this as much as anything else. A check is as good as cash as long as it can be cashed. A rubber check, you don't fulfill the mitzvah with a rubber check. Okay? Again, we talk about that maser money, that tenth of money that you give to tzedakah, that you're obliged originally. You cannot use your maser money for this mitzvah either, because it's a special mitzvah of Purim. It's beyond the regular tzedakah mitzvah. Now, if you're going to give money beyond your minimum, let's say, okay, I have to give $50. So that $50 does not come out of the tzedakah account. But it's Purim, and there's a lot of poor people, and I want to give more. Then you can go, now you can go into your tenth and say, beyond my mitzvah, $50 was my mitzvah. Now I'm going to give $300, $400, $500 from my own tzedakah money and give it on Purim, because that's, they need it. What's beyond the minimum can go out of your tzedakah money. What is the minimum, though, can't go out of your tzedakah money. Now, so anything, basically, anything over $50 for you can be out of your tzedakah money. Now, women and children of our mitzvah are also obligated to this mitzvah. And although a married woman may rely on her husband to give on her behalf, which means to say like this. So let's say Larry and Jackie. Okay, so Larry, you're obliged to give $50 to two people. And Jackie, you're obliged to give $50 to two people. No, 25 and 25 is 50. You have a $50 obligation, you have a $50 obligation. So what Larry can do is, he can say, I'm going to give 50 for me and 50 for you. And your behalf, I'm gonna give for you.
What's about the children?
Hold on, we'll get to the children. That's permitted. It's preferable for the wife to do it personally. Preferable, but not mandatory. And the same for children over bar bat mitzvah. So what's the practical solution for this? So generally the practical solution, now it depends a lot on everyone's personal finances. You know, some husbands and wives, everything's in one pot and everyone does things together. Some have separate finances and have a separate calculation. So again, you know, the traditional family unit that was of 50 years ago, the husband made all the money, the wife didn't make any money. So it was considered the family unit, right? Now things are different in some families, so you have to know. Yeah, I'd say if the wife has her own account and their mom is, this is my money, this is your money, then the wife would have to give her own check. Right? But if it's a family unit where they're together, so the husband says, okay, I'm writing a check now. So, I have, a wife and 6 kids over bar mitzvah. So let's make the calculation. Okay, 50 for me, 50 for my wife, 60, 6 times 50 is 300, $400. So you write out a $400 check, and you're saying, and you write on the check, the $400 is for my obligation, my wife's obligation, this one's obligation, that one's obligation. Here's the check. This money is on behalf of the whole family. The father is the messenger for the wife and children and is giving on their behalf because it's all the family money, so to speak. So that's one practical solution for that. Or what you can do is you give your children money. Here's $50 and now go give the check. Right? Go give the money that you have for them. So you have to have money. It's not good enough to far as I'm just going to write one check for the whole family. You have to use a little bit of thought and say, you have to put a dollar value to that. If there's 8 people that have that obligation, that's 8 times 50, there's $400 that has to be given. And it's all not from your Meiser money, because it's all obligated. So this is where you tell your older kids, you get your own mitzvah, take care of it, man. But if they're not going to, then you have to try to find a way to help them out with that.
So this okay. would be given communally. I mean, you're not going to look for individual poor people.
That's why I'm saying, usually there are tzedakah organizations that will do that for you, and that's why you take care of them. Now, children who are younger, let's say age 6 or 7, should be trained to perform the mitzvah. They're not obliged, and any of the above methods can be used as well. So if you really wanted to, you would take all your children, you'd sit them down and say, look, Abba's writing a check, look how big the check is. So like this Tuesday, I got to write a check for $550, because including all the kids and everything. And you sit them down, I'm writing a check for $550. Moishi, this is for you, $50. And Menachem, this is for you. We're all giving this check, so that's you're giving the mitzvah for them. And that's how really it should be done, in the proper way, so they really understand. If there really were taka poor people, mamish there, you'd give them the cash and say, give the money, give them a check. And that would be a way to do that as well. All right, so that's giving gifts to the poor. Next. Yeah.
What about these guys that walk into the shul on, these guys that walk into the shul on Purim to collect?
If people walk into the shul on Purim to collect, so the first question you're going to ask is, who are they collecting for? So if they are collecting for a poor person,
no.
Then by all means give them. By all means give them. No question. You should give them. And the fact of the matter is, you give anybody on Purim. On Purim, you don't ask any questions, but you don't have to give so much. You don't have to give $50 to everybody. You could do it like this. Listen, for two people, I'm giving my $50 and I'm doing the mitzvah. Now, let's say you live in Yerushalayim and there's 50 people coming to you for money. You can't give 50 times 25. Just give this one a dollar, this one a dollar, this one a dollar, this one a dollar. But you make sure that two people got a bona fide, generous gift of $25 each. That. So somebody comes to, but I find it, I never see it on Purim. So they always, I don't have any complaints, but it's my contention. People come to collect money all year long. They come from Israel, New York, Montreal, everywhere. They come to collect my door all the time at the worst hours. On Purim, when I want to give to a poor guy, nobody's here because they're back home with their family. I remember one year, a guy came to me 7, 8 years ago. It was Mamish Rachmonis. The guy comes, you can see he has prosthetic devices. And he came collecting. I said, thank you so much for coming. Because I really can do the mitzvah, 100%. You know, so but other place, let's say yeshivas collect money on Purim, you can give tzedakah, but you don't fulfill the mitzvah of matanos levyonim. So you have to be careful that it's going directly to poor people on Purim. Be very careful about that. Yeah.
So I don't mean to be nitpicky, but I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
That
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Like, you know, we discussed the, like this topic, and Larry wrote a check out $400 for both of us and gave to Leonard.
Yeah, so as long as it, but he had you in mind, and that was like, we'd call joint finances. In other words, Larry considers that checking account yours and his. It's for your family, right? It's, if you need to buy a dress, whatever, he'd write a check out of that account. It's a joint. So saying, so my wife has to give $50 to tzedakah, so I want her to be included in that, so that's fine.
So he doesn't have to actually written on the check.
As long as you had it in mind, as long as you have it in mind, in the future it would be better to write it, but as long as you had it in mind, that's fine. That's fine. But Leonard has to have in mind that he hasn't given the money away yet. You're still holding their money. So technically, if he wants his money back, you'd have to give it back to him. I mean, he wouldn't ask for it back, but technically, you'd have to give him his money back if he wanted it back. But that way the mitzvah's done. Okay, we've got to hurry, we've got a few more mitzvahs to go. Mishlach manos, sending food. Another way of bringing unity to the Jewish people is just giving food gifts. Everyone likes to get a gift. So on the day of Purim, again, in the day, you can't do this at night, you have to send at least 2 food items to one person, and that's the minimum fulfillment of the mitzvah. It's praiseworthy to send to more, but bear in mind that the better mitzvah is giving to the poor than this Mishloach Manos. This Mishloach Manos is not designated necessarily for the poor. It could be for the poor, but it's a separate mitzvah. But it's also meant for your friends, or not friends, as we'll see shortly. Now, preferably, you have to give food that can be eaten immediately. So don't bring a raw steak to your friend. You can bring him a cooked up steak right off the grill and come to his house and here's a steak. You could do that. But raw food that's not ready to be eaten, you can't do that. It should be two separate food items. Two separate food items. For example, you shouldn't give two apples, because that's like just apples. But they don't require two separate blessings. So you could give an apple and an orange. That would be the minimum amount to the mitzvah. You can give drinks. You could give. You could give a pineapple and a bottle of wine. It could be two drinks. It could be two types of solid food. It could be one drink, one type of solid food. It could be two different cakes. It could be a Boston cream pie and a strawberry shortcake. That's two different foods. You could do that too. So as long as two separate things. Don't give them two chocolate donuts. Give them one chocolate donut and one sprinkle donut. That would be two separate things. Okay? Now, obviously, the food should be a respectable quantity according to the standards of the sender and the recipient. So if I'm going to give a gift to a wealthy person, and I give him a donut and a can of soda, that's an insult. You'd have to give him something that a wealthy person would consider a gift. Now, I would caution you, maybe don't give to wealthy people. It's going to be too expensive for you to give them a gift that they like. But if you're going to give a wealthy person, you got to give him something that he's going to appreciate.
But isn't the whole object of Purim to give to poor people?
Not only. Mishloach Manos is different. We want to develop camaraderie. And that is not necessarily relegated to poor people. A wealthy person, on the other hand, has to send a nicer package than a poor person sends. If a wealthy person sends, and even to a poor person, but it's from a wealthy guy, you should be expecting more from a wealthy guy. So it's very, you have to be very careful what you're giving. You want to give a gift that person says, wow, that was very thoughtful of them. So, of course, when you have little children, my six-year-old, so what are they going to give? So my little six-year-old, he's going to get a little can of soda. He's going to take a little chocolate bar. He's going to give it to his friend, for his five-year-old friend. That's very nice. A little kid likes a chocolate bar. And he feels, oh, you like me. When you get older, it's not going to work. You know, it's not going to work. So you want to give to somebody, you got to show that, you know, it doesn't have to be thousands of dollars, it doesn't have to be hundreds of dollars, but it should be something that shows, you know, that was a very thoughtful gift. And you don't have to spend hours, you know, coming up with shtick and themes and, unusual and unique things. That's not what Purim's all about. You want to just, that Shalach Manos should taste of your love. Your love should be in that Shalach Manos, and the person should sense your love in that Shalach Manos. So I know my mother of blessed memory and all the Holocaust survivor ladies on Purim, what they did on Erev Purim, they would bake a storm. They would bake a storm. They wouldn't make this stuff a whole year long. I mean, all kinds of hamantaschen and unbelievable stuff, you know, and they made it with their feelings. It's Purim and it's this. And they prepare beautiful little, like a tray of cakes and cookies, and we would take it over to them, and then they would say, yeah, and this one, you know, so my mother was Polish, and the other lady was Hungarian, so my mother would have her Polish delicacies, and she'd have her Hungarian delicacies, and that was Purim. See, Mommy, you don't buy that in a store. I'll take the $30 special. I'm not saying you can't do it, I'm not saying that's not the mitzvah. But I'm saying when life was simpler and people were more in touch with their feelings, you know, so you gave something that was a personal gift. It showed that I made something for you. That's the highest way to do the mitzvah. Unfortunately, we're busy people. We don't have time for these things. But you can imagine if you would bake a challah, you were a good challah baker, and you baked a really nice challah, and you made a nice piece of gefilte fish, and you sent it to somebody. You know, that person made it for me. You know, provided they're a good cook, obviously. So you gotta figure, so the gift has to be a thoughtful kind of a gift that the person will really say, that was a really nice thing. And not just any standard type of gift. And that's why we have to be careful that a lot of people, let's have a lot of people on their list. I got 40 people on my list. You know, you don't have to gift to 40 people. You know, and if you do, you gotta make sure at least one is a proper gift. One is really spending relatively a lot of money. I'm not going to tell you what, I'm not going to put a price at $50. I don't know, a nice fruit basket and with some beautiful words written in it. That's what's key, not just from the Mahalowitz family, like to my friend who I value more than anything else, and I wanted to give you a special Mishloach Manos. You know, at least one should be like, where you say, I know we've had differences in the past, and you know, maybe we can forget about those differences, and you really were good friends, and you give him the shalchman and say, oh, that was thoughtful, he was thinking of me. And then, okay, you got your token ones for $5, and you sent to 20 people, so they don't think you forgot about them. But you gotta make sure you've done at least one proper, the mitzvah's done in the best way possible. Yeah?
If you know you can't see someone on Purim Day, can we, bearing in mind that we're going, or can we say to ourselves that we're really supposed to give this on Purim, and
again, if you give it before Purim, it's a nice thing to do, but you have not fulfilled the mitzvah. Hmm. You have to give it on Purim. You can call up a delivery company and say, on the day before, and say, I want to order a fruit basket, deliver it tomorrow on Purim. Then you've done the mitzvah, because they've been your messenger to deliver it for you, so that you could do that. I'm not saying don't give to them beforehand, but you gotta, because you're not gonna see them, they're gonna get insulted, give them. But you haven't done the mitzvah. You're gonna have to go to somebody else on Purim and give them only one. And you've done the mitzvah. Yeah?
Well, you're collecting money for packages to give to the poor on Purim. Does that fall under this?
So you have to know. If you're collecting for packages for the poor, you have to know what it is. You know?
The cards, for example. Like, I've been selling the cards, the link cards.
Just cards.
Yeah.
The cards. So you're giving money to the poor. So it would have to be... So that money goes to the poor. So you'd have to have at least... It would have to be at least $25 worth to fulfill the mitzvah.
It says four food packages.
I don't know how much the cards cost. $5?
No.
Three. So guy would have to buy, let's say, nine cards for $25. And if you want to fulfill the mitzvah.
No,
I'm not saying it's not a nice thing to give tzedakah. It's always tzedakah. But we're talking about how am I fulfilling the mitzvah? How am I fulfilling? So if you're giving them $25, then you've done the mitzvah once. If you give them $50, you've done the mitzvah twice. So if you buy $50 worth of cards, or you don't need so many, I only need five cards, but I'll give you $50. So give him a $50 donation, and then on Purim, he'll give that money as money for the poor, and then you give out cards. Who you want to give out cards to?
But technically, even if you got $1 for two people, you're fulfilling your mitzvah, wouldn't you?
No.
Because it says you have to give only charity. There's no specific...
No, there is a minimum amount.
Because this book just says technically you can give one penny to each.
I don't agree with that. I cannot.
I mean, but that's
I would not say that you have fulfilled the spirit of the mitzvah at all.
The spirit of the mitzvah is to feel for the poor person. That's
so a dollar isn't called feeling for the poor person.
No, I'm saying.
If you would ask me a shayla, if I fulfill the mitzvah by buying one card for $3, I would say no. You haven't done the mitzvah. Someone who lives in Toronto and we're Baruch Hashem affluent. What's $50? We waste $50 on an Irish kite. So yeah, for sure you have to give it. Specifically, the day before you spend $50 on a magazine. You know, on a stupid thing, right? So for the midst of, you can't give $50, I'm not talking if you're unemployed, you don't have money. If you're a regular person, you Baruch Hashem, you make a living. You for sure have to give that.
But just as a matter of interest, the $50 works the other way as well, okay? Because people so intent on giving $25 each, they really... forgetting that there's so many poor people and I could give $200, okay? They're so intent on $25.
No, so that's why we're saying you can give more.
I know,
you should give more.
So it's setting their head up. I've done my mitzvah, I've given $25.
So that's the minimum. We always say what the minimum is, and that's why I put in bold on the sheet, it's better to spend more on this mitzvah than on the other mitzvahs of Purim. Clearly you should give as much as you can. Without a doubt. Spend much more money to give to the poor than fancy shalachmanis to friends. Without a doubt.
So with all the money that I've collected and put in an envelope, and I haven't given it to him yet, so I'm holding that money
right
for these people.
But it's from other people.
It's from other people.
So you can give it to Leonard whenever you want.
And now I'm going to give it to him.
And then Leonard's holding it for them.
And then he's going to hold
it.
Okay.
And he's going to give it on Purim for everybody else.
So
that's how he's doing it.
That fulfills number six, not number seven, obviously. Not the same food.
Food is a different mitzvah.
It's a different. It's
two separate mitzvahs. Yeah. I gave poor to the poor. Fine.
You
money to the
money
poor.
Now
I have to give a gift basket of food. You have to mamish give food. You could give it also to a poor person, and part of the idea is there were poor people who were too what do you call it? Too, what's the word? Not humble. proud that they don't want to get any tzedakah. They don't want, I don't want your tzedakah. So don't get my tzedakah, but I have a mitzvah to give food to people. Do me a favor. Eat the wonderful cookies I made. Here, have a chicken. Right? It's a present. It's not charity. That's part of the idea. There are people who won't accept charity. Okay, but people can give me food. I'm giving you food. Everybody's sharing their food. It's also another unifying thing. You know, we don't eat in their house. They're not so frum, you know. But on Purim, you give us a basket of food. We eat from everybody. Right? So you have to give food. It's a separate mitzvah to give food. And at least to one family. This mitzvah is for women, children over bar bat mitzvah. Same idea. You can't use your meiser money. Can't use your tzedakah money for this mitzvah. Again, according to some opinions, one package can be sent on behalf of the entire family. We could say from the Michalowicz family to the Schwartz family. And everybody in my family could be Yotzei, provided that I have two food items per person in my family that's giving. So the Michalowicz family would want to give one basket to another. We'd have to have 22 food items on that basket if we want the whole family to do the mitzvah with one basket to another family. You see? Now, you might not want to do that. You might want to just say, you know what, better yet, we'll take 11 baskets. And, you know, one basket will be for one member of the family, one member for another member of the family, and we divide it up that way. So there's other ways we can do this. So there's different opinions over here. Some say a family on behalf of a family, right? According to other opinions, only husband and wife can do it together, but children have to send their own. And children should prepare their own. And if they prepare their own, though, it's got to be with their food. So when you're the parent, you say, I'm giving you some apples, I'm giving you some candy, and now make your own shalach manas and give it to the kids. And that's your own mitzvah that you're giving to the other kids. So you gotta be careful that the kids are very much doing these mitzvahs, and it's not just, oh, I did it for them and they're playing the whole day. You've gotta really legally incorporate them. And again, children who are young should be trained to do this mitzvah as well. Now 10 is a very critical point. It is praiseworthy to send packages to Jews who know little about Torah. This will arouse their interest in Jewish practices and increase love and friendship between Jews. The priority should be on secular Jews. You have friends at work, give them shalach manas. You may even have to go to work on Purim, so you bring the shalach manas for them. In a similar vein, this is an ideal opportunity to repair broken relationships by sending packages to people with whom one has ill feeling. If you've had a falling out with somebody, you know, whatever, there's a misunderstanding, and they didn't invite you to the bar mitzvah, and you're a little bit upset, you're ticked off at them, you kind of avoided them in shul. So Purim, you come up, here's a gift, I love you. So what comes out really is that really you're not giving shalach manas to your friends, to your good friends, that you're good friends with right now. There's no purpose is accomplished because you already are close with them. And there's so many more valuable opportunities of mishloach manas that you could have. So specifically those people that you don't like, those people that you are upset with, are bedafka the ones you should be giving the mishloach manas to. Because it shouldn't be poor goes by that there's people that you're unhappy with. So that, or people that don't know about Yiddishkeit. So that's why taka people give to their in-laws. Sometimes it's not the best relationships. But if you have a great relationship with your in-law, then you don't have to give them, unless you think they'll be insulted. And then by not giving, they'll be insulted. We don't insult anybody. So that's a whole different view than usually people, they just give to their friends. I'm giving my friends. I say, don't give to your friends, give to your enemies. Give to the bully in the class. Because that's the one you gotta be able to build bridges with, not the people that isn't that way. Okay, now, one may not send packages to mourners. A mourner is sad and you don't give him shalach manas. However, if there's another family member in the mourner's family who's not mourning, then you give the package to the family and not to the mourner per se. If Mr. Schwartz is mourning, but if Mrs. Schwartz is not, you give a package to the Schwartz family. And it's not specifically to Mr. Schwartz who's mourning. On the other hand, a mourner is obliged to perform the mitzvah, but he does the minimal amount. He sends one package and not a very elaborate one at that. Also, if you receive a package from someone that wasn't on your list, you're not obliged to reciprocate, although it's praiseworthy because we're afraid it could cause ill will if somebody gives you. And if you think they're expecting one back, then it's a praiseworthy thing to give back. According to prevalent custom, you may personally give the gift. And according to some opinions, it's preferable to have a messenger. Because the Torah says, Mishloach manos. Mishloach manos means the sending of gifts, not the giving of gifts. And usually you send it with an intermediary. And the truth of the matter is, it's a more honorable way. Like, what do women like more? When the husband brings home the flowers? Or ding dong, oh, who's at the door? Oh, this is for you, ma'am. And there's a florist there with a bouquet. Somehow you feel a little bit, somebody delivered it. There's a greater significance when you know that, it's a whole delivery system. It shows, wow, you know, he really is, you know, it wasn't just he picked some flowers up on the way home. You know, I had to call the guy up. I had to tell him when to deliver it. You know, it's more official. It's usually perceived as more honor, giving more honor than the person himself giving. And that, you should have a messenger that. If you can have a child do that, it's okay, provided you know the child does his job. Here, little kid, give the shalach manos, and you realize the next day he never delivered it. You know, children are children. He may have eaten it out of the way. But let's say you have your kid, and you're in the car, you give them, and he just takes it to the door. That's certainly not a problem. Anonymous packages should be avoided. Because the whole point of Purim is that people should be friends with each other. So if the guy doesn't know who gave him them, Shalach Manos, I don't know who to thank. That's why even though you're very busy on Purim and there's so many packages, go out of your way to at least read who sent you the gift. We get a lot of times we get too much Shalach Manos, and it's just packing up. And my wife already on Purim, she's already taking apart the Shalach Manos and sorting it out. This is Pesach Dik and this is this. You just can't. But I always mock with keep the cards. I want to know who gave it because I want to know who I should be, who I'm thankful to and who I'm appreciative to. So that is that mitzvah. Okay, we're out. Do you want to stay a few more minutes to finish up the last?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Is that right? Okay, listen, if you have to go, you have to go. And if you want to just stay another 5-10 minutes.
Just a question, Rabbi. Who proclaimed all these mitzvahs?
It's in the Megillah. It says in the Megillah. Mishloach manos ish l'reyehu, matanos le'evyonim. To make a suit, it's all written in the Megillah. The rabbi said we have to do it all.
So I've got to go. You need a ride.
Yes.
So I can't stay for that.
I'll go with you then.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so we'll just finish up anyway for those who can stay and for the benefit of the tape recorder.
Sorry.
For those who need to hear, we'll just spend a couple more minutes. So let's just finish up with the talking of the Seudas Purim, the final mitzvah. Now that you've heard the Megillah twice, and you've given gifts to the poor, and you've given gifts to your friends, so now it's time for the community to get together, for you to get together with friends, and celebrate Purim together. And this is called the Seudas Purim, and it's a mitzvah that, to show the festivities on Purim. Not only do you have a festive meal in day, but even at night, you should have a nicer meal than usual. Even Monday night, you should have a nicer meal. The table should be set like you set it for Shabbos. That's how the house should look. Some of the custom means to have lights on, put candles on when they come home from shul. And you should have a nice meal, not your regular Monday night meal that you normally have during the weekdays. It should be a nicer thing. What I did some years before I was a rabbi with a shul, what I did is I took the kids out to the restaurant. That's a great, there are kosher restaurants open on Purim night. So after the Megillah, we just went to the restaurant. I don't usually go to the restaurant during the weekday, so that's certainly a way of showing honor for the holiday. It's also customary to eat seeds and pod foods, like rice, peas and beans, because that's the kind of food that Esther ate when she was in the palace, because she wanted to keep kosher. And keeping kosher, they had to eat more natural foods than processed foods. So it's a custom, in addition to all the good food you're eating, to have these seeds and beans and things like that. And it's not necessary to eat bread at this meal. Now, it's customary to eat hamantashen. Now, you asked about the hamantashen. So why do we eat hamantashen? So the answer is like this. Everything we have in Judaism, there's a spiritual reason for it. The reason we eat the hamantashen is because we know that it was in the merit of the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who were praying fervently for the Jewish people, and the Jewish people who emulate the ways of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Right? And those are three of our patriarchs. So the Medrash says, on that night, when the Megillah changed, when it looked like the Jews were going to be annihilated, and Mordechai was going to kill, that night the king couldn't sleep. He was having trouble sleeping. Why was he having trouble sleeping? He was woken up from the patriarchs who were praying from the Maaseh Machpelah. And the Jewish people were emulating the ways of the patriarchs. And the patriarchs are three. So it says, because of the patriarchs, they use the expression, Tosh Kocho Shel Haman. Tosh in Hebrew means weakened. The power of Haman was weakened because of the triumvirate of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov and the Jewish people who emulated their ways. So therefore, we say, Haman Tosh. Haman Tosh was weakened. He was weakened by the power of kindness, control, and mercy, which is Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And that's what we have a three-cornered mizonos food, right? That is called Haman Tosh. Haman Tosh. Understand? That's why you eat the Haman Tosh. And that's why it's usually a baked food with something hidden inside. Hidden inside. Fruit flavor something. Because all I have Purim is that things were hidden. God was hidden, but really inside God was saving us. So we eat foods that are closed. And specifically poppy seeds, because those were the kind of foods, seeds that Esther ate in the palace because she had to keep kosher. So every time you take a bite out of a Haman Tosh on Purim, besides the yummy taste that it has, but you're really thinking in your mind and saying, I hope I can be deserving to emulate my patriarchs and to be kind and compassionate and in control. And by me being that way, we will weaken the evil forces of Haman that exist in the world. And we know, unfortunately, there are Jews who have a little bit of Haman inside of them. We try to weaken the Haman grip in our community. You know, Haman spoke a lot of Lashon Hara. I'm going to talk about that on Shabbos. That's the Shabbos drush. So we talk Lashon Hara too. So when we talk Lashon Hara, there's a little bit of Haman inside of us. So when you eat that Haman Tosh, and you're saying, I'm eating Haman Tosh, and if I really was kind and in control and I had mercy like my patriarchs did, I wouldn't be like Haman. So that's what the Haman Tosh is all about. It's a very, very beautiful custom. And you eat it throughout the day. Now, the main meal though is in the daytime. The custom is to eat bread. You should eat bread at the Sudas Purim in the late afternoon. And you should try it all possible to have beef. Specifically beef, because beef makes people happy. A steak, something like that, you're happy when you eat beef. It's substantial. Okay, nowadays people's eating habits have changed. We're not going to force you to eat beef, but according to the traditional custom, you serve some kind of beef. It can be as simple as meatballs made out of beef. You know, simple as a salami. Made out of beef. But you should have beef. It should be a real great meal. This is the one time of the year you serve your best meal, not because you want to be a glutton, but it's in honor of the holiday. It's in honor of the holiday. And you know, okay, when you're making a big communal meal, you can't necessarily serve steak. You know, it gets too expensive. But it should be a very good meal. And it should be done in the late afternoon, after you daven mincha, and the meal should continue into the night. It should go into the night, and people deliberately do it. The main part of the meal should be in the day. So you have to find a balance. There are people who are busy, you make it 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, to get the meal going, that you've eaten a substantial part of the meal in the day. But the rest of the meal, dessert and those things, can carry out into the night. And when you finish, you'll be after Purim, but you'll still say the Al Hanisim prayer in the benching. And of course, you should set a spiritual tone to this meal. It's not just a wild party. It's a spiritual party where we take the physical and make it spiritual. And you should do that by studying a little Torah before the meal, a little bit. 30 days before Pesach, you have to learn about Pesach, learn a little bit about the laws of Pesach. You have in mind, you're eating a meal that's a mitzvah. During the meal, you tell over the miracles of Purim, sing songs about Purim. It's a spiritual meal that's enclosed in physicality. So that you have to be careful that it doesn't become just a wild drunken party. And finally, it's a mitzvah for men to drink wine on Purim. According to some opinions, it's a mitzvah, an obligation for them to be drunk to the point where they cannot distinguish between the concept of cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. According to other opinions, you're only required to drink a little more than usual and not get drunk. And if you go to sleep, you'd fulfill the mitzvah, because when you're asleep, you don't know the difference between blessed as Mordechai and cursed as Haman. Well, one thing is clear. Whatever opinion you go by, the sages certainly did not expect you to make a fool out of yourself and behave in ways that are not becoming. The intention of drinking more wine is to get closer to Hashem and using that joy to reach the highest levels of getting close to Hashem. If you know that if you get drunk, you're going to be a terrible person or you're just out of control, you should not get drunk. If, on the other hand, there's certain tzaddikim, they could drink gallons of booze and nothing happened to them. They got very, very happy. And there's one story with a tzaddik. I don't want to get the whole details of the story. It was an unbelievable tzaddik. He could drink like mamish gallons of liquor. And a lady came to him with a shayla, with a very complicated halachic shayla a couple of days before Purim. It was very intricate. She needed a get. She couldn't get a get. Very complicated. It would be a big scholar to know this. He said, wait till Purim. I'll give you an answer. Comes Purim. The rabbi drinks. He drinks everybody under the table. He says, call the lady in now. Okay, you want to know if you can get divorced? I'm going to now write a responsa. He writes 25 pages. The most complicated, intricate Judaic law permitting her to get married. What was he trying to prove? He's trying to prove that no matter what you do, no matter how intoxicating an experience can be, a Jew is always sober. A Jew never loses control, even if he should lose control. And that's what Purim's all about. Now, only if you're on that level. Only if you're on the level, you drink to that extent. Otherwise, you don't. If you're not on that level, you drink a little bit just to break the inhibitions. The guy that you are upset with, that he didn't invite you to his bar mitzvah, and you're not talking to that guy, maybe you take a couple shots of single malt scotch, and he takes a couple shots, and you dance a little bit, you say, you know what was the big deal? He didn't invite me to the bar mitzvah. You give him a big hug, and he's your friend from now on. And that's the reason why they wanted people to drink. That's the way you're able to fulfill the mitzvah. Okay. And obviously, of course, we wear costumes and masks on Purim. It's a mitzvah to do that too, because we realize the whole year long we're putting on costumes and masks. A whole year long we're putting airs up in front of people, and we're being phony to so many people. So on Purim, what we do is, on Purim we wear the mask, but you know that the whole Megillah is called Megillas Esther. Megillah means to reveal, Esther means hidden. And the whole point of the Purim is to reveal that which is hidden. So a whole year long, we go with a mask and we recognize it. But a whole year long, we don't recognize it. We think that's who we are, but that's not. We're really making a mask. We're trying to show off, put on airs. So on Purim, we make a joke of it. We say, look at the masks I've been wearing a whole year long. And then the greatest part of Purim is when you take the mask off. The real part of Purim is to take the mask off at the end and say, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this. I'm the neshama that's inside it. So anyway, it should all be zochet to have a big, a beautiful Purim and be able to follow the Purim in the beautiful way. And that way we bring the Mashiach that step closer.